Okay, so the next talk, the second talk in the session and the last one before lunch is Andy Millis at Columbia on superconductivity and the pseudo gap in the Hubbard model implications for the Cooper.
All right. Okay. So, folks, it's a great pleasure to be here. And as Andre said, to have a conference focused solely on interesting fundamental questions in superconductivity and related phenomena. And I think we're all very grateful to the organizers and the Collège de France for providing us with this opportunity. So what I want to do in this talk is two things. We'll see if I get to both of them. First, to tell you some of the things that we know or believe we know about the Hubbard model from the point of view of cluster dynamical mean field theory. And then in 5 minutes that I probably don't have, give you a coda about slowly fluctuating density wave order that emerges from beautiful experiments done by my Columbia colleague, Abhay Passapathy. And this work is supported by the US NSF. Probably the most important thing to say about the first part of the talk is that it's done with Emmanuel Gull. And then presumably there's a way to turn this on, but we'll see. Some of the work was also done with Olivier Parcollet and Antoine Georges and an outstanding graduate student who unfortunately has joined the forces of evil and gone to finance, and so she's trying to destroy our world instead of understand it. Okay. So, look, there are two approaches you can take to the cuprates, and I want to take the left-hand path in this talk and focus on what I conceive of as the essential behavior in the cuprates, which are superconductivity and the pseudo-gap. So just to summarize very briefly, because I think we all know this, the essential features live on the holdout side of the cuprates. There is a Mott insulating phase at half-filling, giving rise to an anomalous normal state characterized by a pseudo-gap, that is to say, a momentum-dependent suppression of the density of states, which is then unstable at a lower temperature to a superconducting state with dx squared minus y squared superconductivity. Now, back in 1987, not 88, Phil Anderson said that the two-dimensional square lattice Hubbard model has the essential features of the physics of the cuprates. And I think that the proposition that I would like to put to you, which I hope is not terribly controversial, is that we have very good reason to believe that Anderson was correct in this point. More specifically, we have good reason to believe that the two-dimensional square lattice Hubbard model has momentum space differentiation, that is to say that the properties get progressively more anisotropic in momentum space as you go from overdope down to the Mott insulator. It has a dx squared minus y squared superconductivity in a dome with a TC of the correct order of magnitude, and it has a pseudo gap consistent with many of the features observed in the cuprates. Finally, in the Hubbard model, I would claim the pseudo gap and the superconductivity are competing phenomena. Essentially, they fight with each other. We believe, at least I believe, but I think it's fair to say that I do not have complete and convincing evidence that the two-dimensional Hubbard model lacks, at least in any strong form, charge density wave order, by which I mean stuff independent of charge which comes along with spin stripes, or nemeticity. So there is this implication, which we can discuss in the discussion section. All right, so why do we, or at least I, believe this? The short answer is here. And there's two more papers going back to 2008, and I'm just going to skim over some of the results of these papers. And there's a lot of related work by various people, many of whom are in this audience. Okay, so the essential theoretical tool is really due to Antoine Georges and Gabi Cotillard and his dynamical mean field theory. You've heard a lot about this, but I just want to say in brief, what this thing gives you is an approximation to the electron self-energy in terms of some number n of parts, which are obtained by some calculation which is more simple than solving the full model. All right? If the number of parts goes to infinity, you recover the exact solution. And there are various ways to do this, which we don't have to go into in detail here. Okay. Now, there's a long story about the flavors of dynamical mean field theory and the number of approximants you need. Particularly the smaller approximations have various quirks, the n equals 1 approximation has a Mott insulating state with an extensive entropy. It has a structure of mid-gap states near the Mott insulator. I at least believe that the n equals 2 and 4 approximations emphasize singlet physics much more than the larger n approximants to the Hubbard model and give you a slightly different view of the pseudo-gap. All right, so what we have done is take one particular flavor which was introduced by Mark Jarrell and collaborators, which is that your self-energy is piecewise constant in momentum space, so you just take your Brillouin zone, you tile it into some number of parts, you get a self-energy which is different in each part, which you can find out by doing calculations I don't want to talk about here. There's an obvious bad feature of this, which is that the self-energy you get is piecewise constant. It has discontinuities in momentum space. My view is that you just have to suck it up and live with it. All right? There are proposals to interpolate. In my view, they have the potential for putting in things by hand that are not necessarily there. In my view, you should just live with this, with the problems that are produced by this, and see what you get. There are alternative approaches which have their own issues, which you then have to deal with, and we just haven't particularly investigated them. So with that caveat, some results. This is the basic result, which comes from these papers, and is quite similar to things found by other people. You start with a Mott insulator, which turns on at half filling when interaction is above a critical value, that's this red line, as you do hole doping, but in a model with reasonable particle hole symmetry, not electron doping. What you see is as follows. Out here, what you have is a Fermi liquid phase with an essentially isotropic, that is to say, very weakly dependent on momentum self-energy. You come in doping, you have a crossover, which is not precisely defined, to a region where you see differences between the self-energy in different parts of momentum space. Then you hit this yellow thing, which is the pseudo-gap, and then you hit the Mott insulator. No. Well, it is. It is. But basically, all our studies are at non-zero temperature. And you should think of this as being at any reasonable low temperature. All right? And these things are not exactly, let's say at non-zero temperature, these are regimes, not phases. All right. So this is a bit of evidence for the differentiated phase, this darker blue thing here. This is an estimate of the electron scattering rate, which was divided by temperature for historical reasons. So a straight line is a T squared scattering rate. If you're way out here, you see that self-energy in near the zone face and near the zone diagonal are the same and have about the same temperature dependence. As you come down, they get progressively different. All right? When you cross this line, what happens is that you open up a gap around the zero pi point and not around the zone diagonal point. Here's an example. We just did some calculation. This is, in fact, for this 8-site cluster. So this is the density of states in this region C around 0 pi. This pink thing is a high doping. As you go down in doping, you see a gap open up. This is at a temperature which would be about 400 degrees in physical units. If you were to take this to zero temperature, there would be a gap. Each of these guys would have a gap, a full gap at different size. This filling in is a non-zero temperature effect in the calculation, right? You make the corresponding thing along the zone diagonal and you don't see a gap. All right, now this thing, this pseudo gap, does not connect smoothly to the Mott gap. This is twice the maximum gap value, basically what you get just by looking at the peak-to-peak distance here. This thing extrapolates to some value as doping goes to zero. That value is about half the value in the Mott insulating state. It's a different thing. It's related, but it's a different thing.
What are the units?
T, hopping T. Sorry, should have said that. All right, next. This thing at zero temperature within this momentum space approximation corresponds to a sharp T equals zero transition. In the calculation, you have two phases, one where there is a gap here and one where there is not a gap. At non-zero temperature, of course, there's no sharp distinction. But at zero temperature, you have gap or no gap. The signature in the self-energy, for those who like self-energies, is that a pole shows up in the self-energy in all the approximants bigger than n equals 4. This is the imaginary part of the self-energy, again obtained by analytical continuation. At high doping, this black thing, you see the Fermi liquid form, a minimum at zero, and approximate quadratic growth. As you go down in doping, you see a hint of a little pole here, and it grows as you go down. As far as we know, the transition is continuous, meaning that as you go to zero temperature, the strength of this pole turns on smoothly. It's of course possible that it's a weak first order transition that we didn't pick up. But this is the picture that we believe is most consistent with our results. We have a sharp T equals zero transition at non-zero temperature. You have a crossover. All right. As I say, this crossover corresponds to a reasonably sharp change in physical properties. If this thing were not a second order transition but were a first order transition, this crossover would still be there and would have basically the same properties. All right, now, where does this thing come from? We have partial information and we're getting more. So far, what we have found is that the onset of the pseudogap is associated with a growth of anti-ferromagnetic spin fluctuations. Now you have to bear in mind that this approximation is a very blunt instrument. We have coarse momentum resolution. We can't see stripes and things like that. Basically, you can see commensurate anti-ferromagnetism and wave vectors quite substantially removed, all right? So within that statement, basically the only thing that starts to become interesting, and I apologize for this rather busy plot, just look at the solid lines. The only thing that becomes interesting is that as you cross the pseudogap region, here you go sort of yellow-green, is that the spin correlations around the anti-ferromagnetic wave vector get big. All right, these are equal time impurity model correlations. We're working on getting the real dynamical correlations and we don't quite have them yet, but we should have them by the summer. Basically, nothing else is interesting. You can look at other wave vectors, and as you go away from the pi-pi point, it goes down. You can look at the pneumatic fluctuations, fluctuations in density between the different momentum space sectors. They're all boring. We don't see anything interesting in this calculation except for the anti-ferromagnetic fluctuations. Again, I remind you, this is equal time impurity model calculations. We need more information here, but this is what we know at the moment. There is, however, as you heard from André Marie, a strong sensitivity to breaking C4 symmetry. If you put a C4 symmetry breaking in, what will happen, at least in this kind of scheme, is that, you know, this pole will turn on in this sector, say, before it turns on in that sector. And if you have a pole in one and not in the other, you get big effects. So this will exhibit pneumatic phenomena in that sense. Okay, so this is what I just told you. Now, superconductivity. Right? Again, there is a lot of beautiful work. I think these are the two pioneering papers that looked at superconductivity in this formalism. There's been a lot of other nice work. One thing that I particularly wanted to highlight is this paper by Mark Jarrell and collaborators from about a decade ago. They looked at a relatively modest interaction. It's this point, so it's down below the mod insulator and the pseudogap and so on. So they could do calculations. They went up to quite large clusters of size 26 atoms. And what they computed was the pairing susceptibility. That's this PD for D-wave superconductivity. And what you're supposed to take away from this is that the susceptibility bounces around a bit from size to size, but basically the inverse susceptibility is going to zero at some temperature for all these big sizes. I think this, to me, was really convincing evidence that the Hubbard model does have D-wave superconductivity living in it at a non-negligible interaction and a reasonable doping. All right, so what we've done more recently is construct the superconducting state and determine some of its properties, and I'd like to take you through that briefly. So that's what's in here. I should say that the announcement paper in 2013 took rather a long time to get published. It was after these two. I was hoping that we weren't going to get the announcement paper through PRL until all of our follow-on papers were published, but finally the referees were a little too fast for us. Okay, so there's a phase diagram. This is, again, rather busy. This is at a temperature which isn't as low as we've gone now, and the basic point I want to show you is that, in particular, you have a superconducting phase. That's this pinkish thing, which is generically separated from the mod insulator by a range of non-superconducting but pseudogap phase. This purple line is where the normal state pseudogap turns on by whatever approximate criterion you like. This is just a crossover, so you could move this line around a little bit. And there are differences between the different approximations, but they're basically telling you the same story, that there's a dome. And in particular, what I like is that you go out, the doping-dependent part at reasonable interactions is basically the same between these two guys. All right, the transition temperature. Here's a plot of transition temperature versus U, that's the red guys, versus doping, that's the black guys. It tops out at about 0.04 times T. If you translate that into regular units for these parameters, it's 170 Kelvin. I'm sure you go up to slightly higher U, it'll go up a bit, as Andre Marie showed. The gap is kind of interesting. It's the same thing. The red guys are the gap as a function of interaction as I go up to the mod insulator at half filling. The black is as a function of doping. What you see is that it just goes up, 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 up until you reach the end of the superconducting phase, and then blop, it dies. So the superconducting dome, the TC has a dome. The superconducting gap does not. The transition between the superconducting phase and the non-superconducting pseudo-gap phase is, in a sense, first order. As you go along at low temperature, you have superconductivity, the TC goes up and down, the gap stays big, and then you hit here and it dies. That's the first evidence that these are just competing phases. All right, some other physical properties. We computed, for example, the Raman scattering as a function of temperature. Here, look at this one, the red dashed line. Well, the black dashed line is normal state, relatively high temperature. The red dashed line is normal state, low temperature, where the thing really wants to be superconducting. The blue is at the same low temperature, but it's in the superconducting state. So you're here sort of in the optimal to overdoped side. You have a Raman scattering intensity, which has a broad continuum. This, by the way, is B1G for aficionados. You go superconducting, you carve out a superconducting gap, and you turn on a big B1G coherence peak. You go to the underdoped side over here, there are two things that happen. The big B1G, the normal state gets suppressed. The temperature dependence is opposite. Here you see that at high temperature you have a slope, at low temperature you have a steeper slope in the normal state. That's just the usual drop of the scattering rate with temperature. Here you're opening up the pseudo gap, so the temperature dependence goes the opposite way. The red is below the black. You go to the superconducting state, the peak is at a higher energy and much broader. And I would submit that that's what's seen in the Raman scattering. You compare overdope to here and underdope to here. You can look at the kinetic energy, which goes back to the optical conductivity. The scales are very small, but this is basically what various people, including Dirk van der Marl and Nicole Bontomps and her group, observed, that in the overdope side or the Fermi liquid side, basically, you go into the superconducting state and the kinetic energy goes up, goes down in magnitude. These guys are negative, I should say. So this is a kinetic energy which is closer to zero than that one. On the pseudo gap side, it works the other way. All right? And the reason is that the superconductivity changes the state. Here in the pseudo gap side, what you see is that as you lower the temperature in the pseudo gap state, you're losing kinetic energy. The superconductivity turns off the pseudo gap, so it gives you back some of the kinetic energy. Right? And the trends in magnitudes are about what's seen. Okay, finally, interplay between superconductivity and the pseudo gap, that's over here. These are just calculations averaged over momentum of the tunneling density of states. This is in the overdoped region. You see kind of what you expect. This is a normal state density of states. You go superconducting, you lose stuff here, you grow a gap. Here on the pseudo gap side, you see the normal state pseudo gap, that's this black dashed line. You go into the superconducting state, you grow a feature, and the thing I want to draw your attention to is that the superconducting gap is smaller than the pseudo gap. That's again a statement that these phases compete. You turn on the superconductivity, you weaken whatever the pseudo gap things are. You're not supposed to add superconducting and pseudo gaps in quadrature or anything like that. Superconductivity just weakens the pseudo gap. All right, and this kind of thing is more or less seen in the data. Okay, now here is simulated photo emission spectra. What I've done, remember, we have very coarse momentum resolution. Here's a snapshot of a fragment of the Brillouin zone. This white area is the sector around zero pi, which should be labeled here. This dashed line is the Fermi surface. We're at half filling for reasons I can discuss in the discussion section. And what I'm going to show you is a cut in momentum space, which is this horizontal line. So it goes from outside the Fermi surface to inside the Fermi surface to outside. So this is what you expect in the normal state, right? You just have a dispersing quasiparticle, which is sharp at the Fermi surface, these dashed blue lines. It gets broad when you go away. It propagates above the Fermi surface and you cease to be able to see it. right? Now you go superconducting, and again, you see what you expect, right? The superconducting gap pushes back the states near the Fermi surface. It affects things less here. It reduces the scattering rate. And it gives you a backfolding, right? Here you see a band which goes happily off above, and now in the superconducting state, you see the Bogoliubov friend of that, which is reflected below the Fermi level. Now you go to the pseudo-gap regime. Here's the pseudo-gap. You get a broadened weakly dispersing peak. Here, you turn on superconductivity and you get an essentially non-dispersing state inside the pseudo-gap. You also note, especially in the superconducting state, what photoemission aficionados call a peak-dip-hump structure, right? You have the quasi-particle peak, you have a minimum, you have another maximum. Here's a version of this, which is just an energy dispersion curve. Okay. For different regimes in the Fermi liquid, you see the quasi-particle peak, it's just set back. There's a very weak peak-dip hump. You go to the pseudo-gap regime, you have a quasi-particle peak, which is inside the pseudo-gap by a noticeable amount and a more pronounced quote-unquote hump. All right, where does this thing come from? The standard interpretation of the hump is that it's a shake-off. This peak corresponds to turning on some kind of scattering mechanism. All right. Mathematically, if you look at your Green's function, what that says is that the hump is because this part is off resonance and you're activating a new contribution to the scattering part. This is not what happens in the Hubbard model. Instead, what happens, the origin of the hump, as you can see from these various plots, is that it's where this thing vanishes. Right? What you're doing to make this hump is rearranging the real part of the self-energy in such a way as you get a new set of states at a farther range away from zero to be in resonance. It's not turning on a new scattering channel. You can see that nothing interesting happens in the imaginary part of the self-energy where the spectral function peak is, but this thing in the real part is what's crossing zero or getting near. All right, pairing mechanism. You construct the gap function, you look at the imaginary part of the gap function. This is what we see. Basically, all a pairing comes from low frequency, relatively low frequencies. And I'll just skip over that. So to summarize, many years ago, Doug Scalapino asked if the two-dimensional Hubbard model has the right stuff to account for the essential physics of high TC superconductivity. And the answer that I want to propose to you is yes. And that these things, pseudo-gap and superconductivity, are basic phenomena of strong correlation physics. Okay, so that's this. Now, there are some issues which we can come back to. In particular, this calculation is a very blunt instrument. It's given us some interesting information, but there's a lot of stuff you would want to know, which is very hard to get out of this, and we don't know it yet. All right, now, as a coda in the last 2 minutes, I want to say something which is based on data of Abhay Passapathy and theoretical work with Rafael Fernandez on iron pnictide materials, which may have relevance to all these statements about charge order and density wave order in the cuprates. All right? So we know that the undoped iron arsenides have stripe zero pi order below some temperature in this particular compound, 43 Kelvin. Associated with that is a pneumatic order, which turns on at some temperature. You can see this in the resistivity and the scattering and so on. All right. Now, this spin density wave rearranges the Fermi surface. You can see that directly in photoemission. And you can pick it up in scanning tunneling microscopy by doing this quasi-particle interference. And these structures, this is a series of images at a low temperature as a function of tunneling energy. These structures are associated with this reconstruction of the Fermi surface. All right? You can even see it directly in the joint density estates. You rearrange the Fermi surface like this. In the SDW, you just present the joint density of states. That's this lower thing. It looks very similar to the quasi-particle interference that you get from the scanning tunneling spectroscopy. Now, you expect that as you raise the temperature, these SDW-derived features should go away, right? This is the joint density of states again, spin density wave phase, pneumatic phase, isotropic phase above. That should have corresponding consequences for the quasi-particle interference, and it doesn't happen. These features in the quasi-particle interference don't go away until almost 100 Kelvin, a factor of two or more above the ordering temperature. All right, this is more easily visualized just by doing line cuts. You see this thing is still there. Very briefly, with Raphael, we did some very rough and ready theoretical calculations using this Lee, Rice, and Anders, and Ansatz. Basically, the only way to make this work is to assume that the amplitude of the spin density wave fluctuations remains large, consistent with its low temperature value, up to close to 100 Kelvin, and the correlation length remains moderate. All right. So in other words, the data imply that large amplitude, very slow fluctuations of density wave order persist up to sort of like twice the observed transition temperature. The paramagnetic phase, therefore, has a hidden structure. Rather poetically, I'll just say this and then stop. I used to think of the Fermi Sea as like a nice placid lake with modest ripples, which you could treat by RPA fluctuations. That was kind of my picture of the high temperature normal state. What these guys are saying, Passapathy's results, is that we need a different picture of enormous, slowly moving fluctuations. So the thing I want to close with is just to ask, which picture is really correct? Is this interpretation of this quasi-particle interference experiment overly poetical, or is this telling us something important, namely that we should really be think that the normal state is of many of these correlated materials is not this, it's this, and our problem, as you see from this guy here, is learning, if you like, how to intellectually surf on these waves. So with that, I'll stop and thank you.
Thank you very much, Andy.